I think we have a new house. We're in the sort of the final stages. Looks like we've secured it, which is very exciting. But it means I'm going to have to start my gamer den over again. And I put so much work into making my gamer den in my current house just perfect.
Let me ask you, did you make sure that the Naboo Starfighter fits in the new place?
I had the reason we got the new house is so we could have a space for the Naboo Starfighter that is going to go in my gamer den alongside my, you know, the usual stuff, two dartboards, controller koozies.
In terms of like, I know like some people like pre-faded jeans versus like you kind of stressing them over time.
Yes, I made sure that it had been gamed in before, and
have the Dorito powder on all of the walls.
That's actually the color palette that we've chosen is cool. Cooler Ranch.
Cool Ranch. That's great for it's supposed to help you sleep.
Yes, I mean, I'm not going to be doing much sleeping in there. Mostly just gaming with my best friends, Sonic the Hedgehog and Master the Chief. And so I'm going to get in there and, you know, I've got all my Rock Band 1 through 3 and Beatles Rock Band peripherals. Those are going to be all over the place. And I mentioned
Van Halen
the control
Rock Band, I assume.
Van Halen Rock Band
one?
Is forbidden in this household. Mentioned the controller koozies.
Yeah,
you got the controller koozies
there. The floor's made out of batteries. There's just like 2 inches of sort of standing batteries.
What
you
types
can never
of like batteries? A melange? Yeah, like what types?
You know, for my controllers and Game
so
Boys.
Not like the batteries.
I mean, there's bats of all sorts. You know, I play with the Xbox Pro controller, and those take D cells because it's about the size of, my current small bad house.
Yeah, you carry it like a boombox.
I carry it like a boombox, and it's very helpful for listening to Master the Chief's great dialogue in all of his Halo adventures.
Now, do you still have, I don't know if you kept the one I got you for Christmas, but did you keep the 8-foot-tall Crash Bandicoot with working lips that you're able to kiss sort of whenever you want?
Yes, and what's great is I keep him right next to the gamer jelly, and so I can smear that on there whenever I need to moisten Crash.
Okay. My name is Justin McElroy, and I know the best games of the month.
My name is Griffin McElroy, and I know the best games of like a month and a half. We're very late.
My name is Chris Plant, and I've played games.
My name is Ross Frosch, and I do the best games of the week.
Hello, and welcome to the Besties, where we talk about the latest and greatest in pop culture, sports news, Xbox One X releases, Jeff Keighley nomenclature, fashion, news of the day, politics, gaming, fast food trends, new pizzas that are popular. But today we're going to be focusing mainly on gaming.
I mean, you already said gaming. You said gaming.
But we're going to be focusing mainly
on drilling down on gaming.
We're focusing on gaming.
And I think it's worth talking about because there's been a lot of changes recently, and where once there was only Pac-Man, now there seems to be much more.
Mm-hmm. Miss Pac-Man.
For starters.
Yeah.
This is a very late episode, and I kind of thought maybe we just skip November and just do the Game of the Year special, but I think there's probably enough to talk about. This is probably going to be a shortish one.
Yeah, it's going to be short. I would also say it seems profoundly lazy of us to not even be able to do the once a month schedule that we set out.
It's just weird, right? Because November is historically and obviously
it's usually
like,
it's the
bonkers release month.
Yeah.
And now, like, the release schedule is so much more spread out.
Well, that's not entire. I mean, there were huge games that came out in November. Traditional, like Call of Duty came out in November. The Star Wars Battlefront, like a lot of games came out in November. They just weren't.
It
the
wasn't
best
a great month.
Games.
Yeah. We're also going to be talking about the games that we've played so far in December because we're not going to have another chance to talk about those before the GOTY episode. Mm-hmm. Should we do honorable mentions? Because I actually have a couple.
Yeah.
Are we talking about Pocket Camp? Is somebody bringing Pocket Camp? Okay.
I mean, so, I don't know if anyone's bringing it as their pick. I don't even know what my pick is, to be honest.
I don't know what our picks are.
I did not love Pocket Camp.
I'm over it. I played it for 2 days when it was out in Australia, and it's just like, it just doesn't have the soul of that of the game that I want.
Yeah. The thing that bothers me, and it's very simple, is that the things that get me jazzed about Animal Crossing are not making friends. I don't care. I have some friends sometimes. The things that I like are crafting my town, crafting my house, doing all sorts, like collecting shit.
Yeah. Not just doing chores over and over to grind for like levels. Neutered. The timers are really bad. Like really, really.
I didn't even find the timers to be a problem, to be honest. I just didn't care to wait. Like
it's not so much the timers. It's how quickly the timers and the resources. So if you haven't played it, basically you are trying to attract different villagers to your camp. And the way that you do that is by crafting furniture that they want in the camp. And so there's a little checklist that says like, if you want to get this bear to your camp, here are the things you have to make. And really quickly, the amount of time required to craft something escalates from, it starts at like 3 minutes and then it's like 1 hour and then it's like 9 hours, which is like, okay, that just means I have no idea why companies do this. I mean, I do because then there's a way to pay to make it go faster. But for me, and I imagine a majority of the folks who play it, I just say like, well, I guess I'm not playing this game again today. But also the
Animal Crossing had that. It had wait a day until you got the furniture. So
sure, but
what it did not have
is the resources required to craft this stuff also escalates like to a preposterous degree where it starts like, oh, it takes 6 wood to make this chair to like now it takes 120 wood and 60 cloth and 10 preserves or whatever to make this cabinet. And that when you do like a chore, right, when you go and you catch a fish and you give the fish to somebody, they might give you one or two pieces of wood. So you're telling me I have to do this 60 times just to meet the wood requirement for making this cabinet? Like no, thanks. It's not fun.
Yeah, the main thing that is like where you could sort of express some creativity with the design of your camp, I feel like is completely neutered by the fact that you have to have certain items in your camp to lure in certain animals. It like there's literally a button to like throw all the shit you just made to attract somebody there and then okay, press another button to make it all go away. It's like completely it's completely pointless and it robs you of like, how about this? I have a cool camp that I made. And they either like it or they don't. Like, it removes the...
No, he's like, especially since it takes so much time and so many resources to make something. I didn't even start making things that I wanted to have in my camp. I had to save that time and I had to save those resources to, like, do the one sort of progression hook for the game. It's a huge disappointment.
It feels like they took Happy Home Designer, which I don't really like,
drilled
down on the worst parts of that. Like Happy Home Designer, at least, like you went into the house, somebody else's house, and you designed it for them. I don't want to like bury ourselves in this game that I don't think is that good. But I do want to, if you don't mind, share Yoko Taro, the creator of Nier Automata, had something to say about it. Do you mind if I share that?
Yes.
Go for it.
This is from he talked about it on Gamma Sutra, and this is near the end of his kind of rant. He says, I want to say something about the unreasonable shopping. You need to predict what those monsters want, like an Esper, an Esper being a human who possesses ESP, and give those things to them to get your big reward. What is this a metaphor for? Why do you have to collect things that are right next to the monsters to make them happy, like a slave? I guess this represents the divisions between people and class society. I haven't put any furniture or anything in my camp except a kerosene tank. I started this game to get revenge on that raccoon, but now I have a different purpose. I'll enjoy playing this game until I burn that dark forest down.
Damn, Yoko Taro. Speaking of, I finally finished Nier Automata 2 times, and that's a good game. We shouldn't start talking about it again.
No, we should not.
But we did get our Nier Automata in for this week, so we're good.
Yes,
there
check
it is.
That
that's
box.
I've been playing Zelda again, Breath of the Wild, because the new DLC just came out.
Hell yeah. Maybe I want to bring that.
That'll be
my pick.
Well, I thought about that, but I haven't even gotten to the DLC yet because I decided to start over and try playing on Master Mode.
That's a big mistake.
Oh, no, I fucking think it's great. I think it's so much fun.
Yeah, you like it?
Yeah, you're so weak and so vulnerable and basically like it scales up enemies like one class, right? So instead of starting out against these like weak whatever they're called, bokoblins. They're like mid-range bokoblins, like that you're starting out against, so they'll kill you in one shot. And it really forces you to use like all of the cool shit that is in the game that we all talk about, like when we talk about how cool this game is, that you can do all this stuff. You can push a rock down a cliff and kill somebody, or set the grass on fire and kill people that way. And it forces you to use cooking like a lot, just so you can sort of stay on par with these people, instead of just like running up and hitting them with a weapon until the weapon breaks, and then you take their weapon and hit them with that. Like, it really requires you to enjoy all of these different systems that are built into the game in a way that is not just like a fun thing to do when you're stunting, but like a necessary thing to do to survive.
Yeah.
God, what a fucking great game.
Oh, it's tremendous. Should we just decide the game of the year right now?
What else? I feel like we've been playing a lot of stuff. Justin got me on Solitaire.
Let me talk about Call of Duty real quick. All right.
Now wait, okay. Can we do this? Like, we don't know what
maybe
our
we don't have
of
to.
The month are gonna be.
maybe we just have an hour-long freewheeling discussion, because I don't think anything that we're gonna talk about here is going to be a contender in the GOTY list.
Yeah,
so let's just
fine.
I'm fine with just talking
we'll
about shit
loose.
For an hour. Yeah.
Shooting the shit. Call of Duty, I don't know what they need to do. I'm not gonna go in depth, because I've already spoken and written at length about the Call of Duty game World War II and why it doesn't really work. But I guess the question I sort of want to present is, like, can Call of Duty essentially start from scratch and reimagine what it is? And is that PUBG? Like, is it that dramatic a change?
You know what it'd be for me? A Call of Duty game that is only multiplayer, no single player, that is just about having, like, progression hooks and lots of different ways to play online. Because, like...
But isn't that multiplayer? Like, that's the multiplayer version of all Call of Duty games.
I guess so. I just know that if I really drill down into it, then next year there's just going to be a new one.
Yeah.
And the idea of that. And that's why I've been like a Destiny player for as long as I have, because it has that feeling of like the progress that I make here matters. And that's not really, I haven't felt that to be true.
Perma Call of Duty.
The only reason I would play Call of Duty, knowing that it's an annual event, is if it was like the only shooter that I and everybody I knew was playing, which is I don't think the like landscape of games being what they are now, like that's never going to be true ever again, basically. So if there was like something that was as like necessary as PUBG is and necessary as Destiny was when it first came out, like, yeah, I think I would I would still enjoy playing COD.
Yeah, I think what they would need to do is to do what you're talking about, is essentially making like a Counter-Strike Go equivalent or PUBG that sticks around forever, right, and people have value, but it would have to have some pretty intense free-to-play like monetization hooks for them to make up the money that they would effectively lose by not having this hardcore fan base buying the game every single year.
Yeah, it would never happen.
I think there's an easy way to do it. I think the thing is that when they started making multiplayer, single player was still bread and butter of the games, right? You make two games. You don't want to upset an old fan base, which is single player shooter people.
Or three games with the zombie mode, if you want to consider that.
What I mean is, like, you make a thing that keeps a certain fan base, and then eventually like that thing just dies off entirely, and then you move to the next thing, and then you can take risks on something else. So like, finally just cut single player, have multiplayer be the new bread and butter, because it's been that for a long time, and then use all the resources that you would do with the single player mode on whatever your PUBG thing is.
Yeah, like, make cool new types of mode. Like, don't do a standalone zombie mode. Give me like a, you know, terrorist hunt style cooperative mode that uses the same multiplayer character that I have in. I mean, at this point, I'm describing Destiny, I feel like, a little bit, but like, I really do think I could get into that, but it's. When it's just like when the narrative is like, oh, it's another Call of Duty game. I've played so many of those and spent so much time playing those that I'm not interested in it anymore.
Yeah.
Should we go ahead and, so as long as we're talking about this, should we do Star Wars Battlefront 2? Did anybody actually like play that?
Yeah, I played it a little bit. No multiplayer. Just a single player.
I hear that the multiplayer is quite a large sort of part of the piece of the puzzle, though.
Yeah, I'm sure. I just don't I mean, I wanted to play the single player to see if it's, because they did a campaign. That's the new thing. So I want to see the new campaign they did. It's
Justin,
so,
how do you feel about stealth missions?
Oh my God.
And it's starting the game with that.
It's so whack. I mean, it's
bold,
just
bold
so,
choice, guys.
It's so like unbelievably boring. Like, and like the things that you're doing are like so unenjoyable. Like I made it to, I guess it's like the third mission, I guess. And you're going on, you're on Endor and you end up in these, like, you're kind of going from like large skirmish to large skirmish, and you're very vulnerable to enemy attack. So like, and the checkpoints are way farther apart than they probably should be. So there's like, you have to be fairly precise with how you take on an encounter to get through it without getting shot all to hell. And so, like, there was one specific section where, like, I got the drop on some enemies. There were, like, 8 enemies down at the bottom of a hill, and I, like, kind of got the drop on them, snipe a couple of them, you know, throw a grenade or whatever, and then have my little robot taser one of the fools. Just, like, and I figured out how to do it, but the checkpoint was before that. And then right after that was this huge battle where tons of people were shooting at me simultaneously that was really challenging. And so I ended up having to do this one skirmish that I figured out how to do over and over and over again, and it's like, it just feels bad. Like the sniping feels bad and shooting people feels bad, because when you expose yourself, you're really easy to kill. I just found it so just boring. Yeah. I don't know, it is really hard to discuss what works and doesn't work in a first person shooter, especially when you have as little sort of engagement with this particular game as I have at this point. But I can tell you that, like, every time I restarted was like, okay, fine. Yes, fine. Like, there was no joy, no fun, like, not enjoying it. Also, tangentially, I will go to my grave insisting that if you are put into a world where there are somewhere people are using lightsabers and superpowers, and you know that's happening in the universe around you somewhere, and you're like, let me shoot him with a pistol. It's like, I just hate it intrinsically. Like, it's never going to be fun to me. Please, I know people have... No, you cannot convince me that it is fun to me when I know other people have laser swords and are flying around shooting lightning out of their hands.
On the inverse, that my only argument against that is the Old Republic, the BioWare MMO. Actually, like, the other classes, the non-Jedi classes, were, like, super fucking fun. Because you also... because then, yes, in terms of, like... action and combat and shit, like, obviously it's ideal to have a lightsaber and stuff, but like, living out the life of a interstellar smuggler, I think, is way more rad than like, and now we study the books to learn what good is.
No,
and it's like,
banging,
okay,
allowed.
No banging. Meanwhile, smugglers is like, I got a bang ability that I unlocked at level 2. Yeah, we played a little bit of multiplayer, me and Russ and Plant, and I don't really love the sort of big team battle multiplayer genre in general, so I don't feel equipped really to talk about it. But I will say, we played a couple matches of the dogfighting mode that was fucking legit. I had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, that's neat. I think the on-the-ground stuff doesn't work because the big team battles, I think, only work in the sense of, like, Battlefield, where the map is so freaking huge that you have these mini skirmishes all around the map, rather than having, like, oh, there's 12 guys and they just kill me instantly. And it seemed like the maps, I don't know, maybe the maps are a little too small to support it, but I was just, like, running into just a sea of enemies and getting killed instantly every single time.
Which
and
is
that's assuming that there's no lag. Which
it's indicative of, like, you. There's a way of playing these games where it requires group mastery and communication that is not super present in like pickup games like we were playing.
Right.
Let's talk about a good one. I this is one I was thinking about bringing before we decided to do this strange new structure where imagine this, just 4 guys sitting around talking about video games. It's a bold new podcasting.
Innovators.
Yeah. I want to talk about the new Hearthstone expansion, Kobolds and Catacombs, which I've been having a lot of fun with, despite the fact that I haven't actually played that much of the, like, a standard competitive mode with all of the, what, like, 135 new cards that are in the game. Because it is like a, it is not there's two types of Hearthstone expansions, right? Like the big single player expansions where you play through a series of boss fights, unlocking cards as you go, and then by the time you finish it, you basically have everything that's new in the expansion. And then just like standard pack expansions where there's just a fuck ton of new cards, and you buy sure. packs or unlock them in other ways, and then you get new cards. And Kobolds and Catacombs actually fall somewhere in the middle, because there's 135 new cards that you get through packs, and I've gotten a bunch of them, and there's some cool stuff. There's a new keyword called Recruit, which basically when you play a Recruit card, it instantly summons a, you know, certain type of minion from your deck and puts it out on the battlefield, which opens up a lot of new sort of strategies. There's new legendary weapons for every class, which is kind of interesting because a lot of classes don't have weapon cards. Like, it's just not a focus. So like mages have a staff that lets them draw cards at the end of their turn. And there's some new legendaries and some new mechanics that are cool. But I wanted to talk about Dungeon Run, which is the new single player mode that comes in this expansion, where you go up against 8 bosses in a row. You start out with a standard deck from one of the game's 9 classes that starts out with just 10 cards in it, I think. And you start out with 15 health. And then every time you beat a boss, your health maximum increases by 5. And you draw 3 new cards from 3 different themes. So if you're playing a mage, right, and you beat the first boss, your 3 like themes might be arcane, where you draw like, you know, arcane spells, or card draw, where you draw like cards that let you draw other cards, or frost, which gives you, you know, abilities to put ice armor on yourself. And you add those 3 cards to your deck of 10, and now you get 13. And then also, I think at 4 different points throughout the run, you will draw these special treasure cards that transform the game kind of completely. So there's one that makes it so that they're passive. You don't play them. Some of them are passive. So you don't have to play them. They're just always active. So there's one that makes your battle cries trigger twice. So you build your whole deck around that. There's one that gives you a permanent +3 to all of the damage done by your spells, which is just like, okay, now whenever I'm drafting, I just have to pick up like these heavy hitting spells, because now like I can get this huge advantage by taking advantage of these treasure cards that I've drawn. And you really do have to be very, very specific about how you build the deck as you go through the dungeon, because the bosses are so super unfair, like really extreme. A lot of people talk about how it's very easy, and I think that's kind of bullshit, because I played it a lot and I haven't beaten it yet. And a lot of it is like waiting for the stars to align and hoping that you get good cards that you can choose from that align with the strategies you're building around your treasures. But it's really, really difficult.
It's probably falls in line with like a game like FTL where,
yes,
you basically know a strategy that works, and you're looking for specific cards and specific things that will assist you in having known what the boss is going to be like, then you could kind of build to that.
But it's so fun, and it's like a new way to play Hearthstone, because it's not, there's nothing about match to match. It doesn't feel like a traditional game of Hearthstone, because you have built your deck around these weird strategies that just don't apply to the regular game. Like in the regular game, you don't get a passive boost that makes all of your minions have permanent stealth. That just can't happen in a regular game, but it does happen here. And so it turns it into, you're not just playing Hearthstone and trying to keep the usual stuff of, you know, keeping tempo and card advantage and all the regular TCG shit. You are also trying to figure out a way to like exploit with maximum efficiency these like super powerful bonuses, and just trying to stay alive from boss to boss. I think it's I think it's fucking brilliant. There's not even like great rewards for doing it either. Like if you finish the dungeon on all 8 classes, you get a card back. I think that's it. There's certain you get quests when you start playing the expansion that will give you a few free packs, but like that's about the extent of it. I've just been playing it, and this is like rare for me for Hearthstone. I'm not playing it to like get something. I'm not playing it to, you know, complete a quest or get cards or move up my rank or anything like that. I'm just playing it a lot because it's fucking fun. The quest is your reward.
Man, it had been forever since I played Hearthstone. I logged on to check this out, and I got my badge for the May 2016 season of Hearthstone.
Oh, no. Jesus.
But it does an interesting thing when you when you start back up again.
Yeah.
It actually says like, hey, it's been a while. I got like three real basic matches for you, and if you finish them, then you get like three packs of cards. And it's it's like you could skip it if you want to, but then you don't get the free pack. So they're really kind of forcing you to like, let's just like ease back into it. Let's see what's going on here again. And it was like, man, I forgot. Hearthstone's very fun.
It's an extremely good. It's one of the best games ever. It is very fucking good
video game. Like I really missed playing it, and like. I got absolutely housed in the new mode. I mean, I got flattened. I got through the first thing, and then the second boss was like a dragon that was like brutal, just like dropping dragon after dragon on me that like all work together. There's a like a super duper dragon that brings all the dragons you have in your hand out into play at the same time. So I had like seven dragons, and then I ran out of cards, which is a real concern in this mode. Yeah, I ran out of cards and it was absolutely over with. So it was very fun though. I really missed playing Hearthstone, so it was cool.
Yeah, I hadn't played in a very long time when I got back into it. I'd missed a couple expansions, and it always astonishes me because I've taken breaks from Hearthstone before. Like, I feel like it's a really easy game to get back on board because the meta is never like so complicated. There's like a few strategies that people are using to like hit top rank. And it's not too hard to like look at those decks and have like a pretty clear understanding of how people are playing this game right now.
Yeah.
I also played Xenoblade Chronicles 2 on the Switch. Boy, it's
fell
yeah,
asleep.
I really don't care.
I'm a British boy underwater. I'm on a ship, and then he's like, oh no, there's a crystal sword lady, and then I fell asleep. it's not really my kind of game.
It's just the it's so like. I really hate the combat, and I didn't love the combat in Xenoblade Chronicles 1, which I also never finished.
It's just like MMO. It's like generic,
feels kind of generic
combat.
MMO. You're just standing there watching your attacks hit, and you hit the special abilities to charge your meter, it's so like the combat seems very simplistic because you're just standing there and activating your abilities when they're charged up, but at the same time it also seems fucking super complicated because there's like a shit ton of different like statuses and thing like effects that you're trying to apply to enemies to like boost your stuff that is just not explained very well at all.
There is a game that somebody liked this month, and actually I liked it too quite a bit. So I don't want it to be fully a negative month.
No, it was a weird month. I just think we should talk about everything that we play, because I did play a lot of stuff. Oh, I finished Neo, which came out on PC. That's a fucking good one. I think I brought that like when it first came out on consoles.
Path of Neo?
Sort of Dark Souls esque.
Ninja Gaiden game.
Yeah, it's fucking fun, man. I never finished it on the console version, but on PC it looks so pretty and it's so fun. I've been like dying for another Souls game. I didn't think I would be this ready for one this soon, but
that's coming.
First year without a Souls game in a grip, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, we got that Video Game Awards tease, which I'm hoping is for BB2, but I guess we'll see.
Chris Plain, I want to hear about the game that you liked, that I like as well.
I like Getting Over It. I'm actually going to kind of talk about two games because they're both by the same person in some weird capacity. But Bennett Foddy is a friend, I should also say up front, but I also think a fantastic game designer. He designed Quop, the game where you try to run with Q, W, O, and P on your keyboard. Assigned to, what is it, your thighs and your calves?
Yeah, you would recognize it. I feel like everyone on the planet has played this game at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it appeared in The Office. It was like one of those weird browser indie games that like really popped.
It also made Super Pole Riders, which is, in my opinion, fantastic. His fucking masterpiece.
Also really good.
I mean, he has just an incredible ability to like make things feel right. They feels like tangible and a really hard to pin down way with words that just is there and when you play the game. And his new game is, I think, truly the masterpiece of game feel, whatever kind of like intangible thing he's been trying to create all this time. It's called Getting Over It. It is inspired by an old browser game in which you try to climb a cliff, essentially, using in getting over it using a sledgehammer. You are a naked, bald man. You're essentially who's the man who made The Witness? You're Jonathan Blow. You look like Jonathan Blow. Nude.
Is Jonathan Blow that ripped?
In a bot. Are you
it's
kidding?
Pretty ripped in the game. I don't
Dude,
know.
He's yoked.
Don't
he's
mess
jacked.
With J Blow. Yeah, and
what'd
you're
you say
stewing...
about Braid?
Punch, 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 punch. Dead.
You're stewing in juices. I don't know. I assume maybe like a lot of body sweat inside of a giant black cauldron. And you use your sledgehammer to climb up a mountain. And it is very, 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 very difficult to do that. And the game punishes you for even trying. The way the mountain is shaped is so that as you take risks to climb up the mountain using this precarious control scheme, you might accidentally throw yourself back so that you just lost like minutes, if not hours, of progress. Towards the end of the game, you can fall in a way that essentially resets your work. And while all this is happening, there is gentle music, and there is Bennett himself coming over the game on VO, giving you notes about failure and what inspired the game and why
it's
he
very,
designed it.
It's very Stanley's Parable Beginner's Guide. Is that the name of the other?
Yeah.
The other game? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is in that, like, it's a designer talking about design. What I like about it, maybe in a different way than those things, is it leaves a lot of room for the player. Like, it doesn't feel like it's preaching to you about game design. It doesn't feel like it is proud of its braininess. It just feels like somebody having a conversation with you. And it feels like this weird opportunity that I feel like we maybe get to have a bit, but most people don't, to play a game with the person who created it and for it to feel like they're kind of encouraging you through it and providing insight into like what it is you're actually seeing. I just think it is a deeply warm, genuine game that should make you furious, but it somehow never really does. And
it's also like one of the most, I mean, we've talked about how much of a game designer's game it is. It's probably one of the most game designer's games that's also going to be like monumentally successful.
Yeah,
it does not happen
accessible.
Very often.
Yeah. And that's because even if you take the words away, I mean, the game has become a huge, huge, huge hit in South Korea. South Korean streamers love this game.
It's also going to be at every Games Done Quick throughout the end of time, I'm hoping.
Yeah, 100%.
For sure. I don't know. It's just so nice to play a game that feels so warm and so caring and so genuine.
I also wanted to say, for me, like, I love Bennett's games overall. I think they're a lot of fun. But for a lot of them, Super Pole Riders is one of them. Co-op is certainly one of them. For a lot of them, I oftentimes feel like I'm playing, and when something happens that works out in my favor or against me, I don't 100% know why it is. And maybe that's because the control schemes are like so out there that they're kind of removed from my direct inputs somewhat, even though they're not. I just can't like grok like, oh, X means Y in a lot of those games. In this game, you can actually watch. So Plant and I streamed this game probably 2 months ago. And you can watch as I sort of vocalize my thought process of like what I'm going to do next to like make the next jump or make the next ledge drop. And the game is so precise in its movements and so accurate to like what ends up happening after you do those movements that it doesn't feel random. It feels entirely like on the player to succeed and is way more complex than say like, you know, a platformer that is totally on the player to succeed. Like, the number of variables that are introduced based on all this physics engine that he's made
is infinite. Yeah. I also want to talk about, oh, sorry, do you have a thing, Juice?
I think a lot about the importance of feeling the hand of the creator when you're playing a game, that you want to, this idea that if you're going to be playing something, especially something that's really challenging, you want to know that the creator has been there. Like, they have seen you go through this circumstance and you're not abandoned. In bad games, I think it's one of the first things that you lose. It's one of the best ways I know of to get a sense of like something's going to be a bad game. If you find yourself in a scenario where you don't feel like the creator ever intended you to be in, or mm-hmm. they didn't think through you experiencing this. And it's really interesting what he's done with the narration, basically, is like, he lets you know, like, yes, I have foreseen the situation that you find yourself in. I'm specifically referencing what you are going through. Like, I understand what you're going through, and it makes it a lot more palatable, and it makes you something like you want to experience it, because it's like he has seen this happen. Like, you know, you're in a curated experience, even though it can feel very, very frustrating and very sort of like flippant towards your time.
Yeah, yep. I think that's a really great point. I want to talk about one other game that Bennett contributed to, but I won't explain in any capacity how or why, because I think it would be a big spoiler. But did y'all play Universal Paperclips this year?
No. I've not even heard of it.
Oh my gosh.
Wait, that's the paperclip sim, manufacturing sim. Okay.
Yeah. Did you play it?
I played a little bit. I did not know that Bennett Foddy was involved.
Oh, you should finish it. So
okay.
it is the new game from Frank Lance, who was my old boss at NYU Game Center. Again, disclosure. But he made Drop 7 long before he worked at NYU, with a studio that ended up getting acquired by Zynga. And Drop 7, I think, is one of,
super
if not
good
the
game.
Best puzzle games. Yeah, it is fantastic. Universal Paperclips is, it is a clicker game, like so many things, clicky clicker.
Is it mobile or on
Treasure
on
Box? It is PC. Mobile. I would recommend you play it on a PC browser. I won't say why. I think you should. And it is about making paperclips. And it is about everything else. I am going to not spoil anything, because I think this is very much a game that you should experience on your own. The one thing that I will say that I think is pretty evident early on is if you play Cow Clicker from Ian Bogost, if that was taking the idea of like, what does it mean to like waste your time on nothing, Universal Paperclips flips that, and it is, this is actually how the world works. What does it mean to pursue larger and larger numbers, and to, for things to, by having more numbers, to make it easier to continue making even more on that and make multiples? Basically, like, what is the end game of capitalism, the video game? All starting with the idea of making paperclips. It is really, really, really good. You can have it on in the background and complete it in probably 2 or 3 days. But wow, do I recommend it, because it is just full of surprises. And kind of like Getting Over It, even though they're very different games, it is a game that I would strongly encourage you not to look for tips on. It regularly feels impossible, but with 5 minutes of just like taking a breather, you can figure out what you want to do next. Versus, I think, a lot of clicker games, which get to this point. I love Candy Box. Candy Box has these points where it like gets into all these other weird combat mechanisms and everything, and suddenly it becomes like almost a war of attrition with the game, where you're letting it run for weeks. This does not know that. This knows, it clearly Frank knows like how long people actually play these games, and paces itself within that timeline. Yeah, it's fantastic.
I want to talk about Curse of Osiris, the Destiny 2 DLC, but like, I was out of town all weekend, and so I didn't get a chance to play the raid layers. And then today there's an update that comes out that adds masterwork weapons and sort of some changes to the economy. And so I don't want to, we did a stream of it, and I feel like I was too quick to judge, despite the fact that I hadn't really seen everything that the DLC had to offer. But I feel like I can pretty confidently say that the campaign in Curse of Osiris is pretty disappointing, and the new area in the game is not so great. And as somebody who is like looking for a reason to get back into Destiny 2, which I was very, very into until I like finished the shit out of it, It's a disappointment in that sense, because I do not feel that fire to necessarily get back in the swing of things.
Yeah, for what it's worth, I haven't done the raid layer either. But for what it's worth, I have heard that the raid layer is quite good, and different from the normal raid, which is kind of neat.
But, yeah, I'm excited to
yeah.
I'm sure I will hop back in at least probably sometime this week to check that out.
Yeah.
But I don't know. In Destiny 1, there was good DLC and there was bad DLC. And the good DLC was something like The Dark Below, which was huge and transformative. No. And No, not Dark Below. God, I get it confused. Dark Below was the bad one. Taken King, which was huge and transformative and added all these new sort of exciting elements and new ways to play and fixed a lot of the things that were wrong with the base game that people have been complaining about for, you know, for months and months and months. And then there was bad DLC like The Dark Below, which did add a new raid, which was fine, but mostly had just like a really bad campaign and a really shitty economy. And I feel like Curse of Osiris falls somewhere in between, where if the first few hours are supposed to be like a proof of concept teaser for what the rest of the DLC has to offer in the long run, like it's just not very good. It requires you to, there's some repetition of going back and playing other older missions, well, not the missions exactly, but like run through this area and shoot some guys, and you've been in this area a bunch before. One mission is just like one of the strikes from the game that you just sprint through for the most part. And a lot of it takes place in this new environment called the Infinite Forest, which is on the new planet, which is just this pretty uninspired, randomized gauntlet of enemies on these platforms that just sort of materialize in random orders. And it's not very fun to go through the Infinite Forest, and you have to do it like three times just in playing the campaign. And each time it was just kind of a drag. But I feel like I need to play a little bit more of the, you know, Destiny. Like the whole game is the shit you do past hour 20, past hour 30. And I haven't really hit that point in Curse of Osiris yet. But yeah, I'm going to shut up now.
I do want to mention, just in by nature of we're just mentioning games that we played this month. This month, it feels like a lot more indie games are coming out on Switch. Games that came out earlier this year on Steam are hitting Switch now. One example is End is Nigh, which is a Steam platformer that I really like.
Oh, is that on Switch?
Just came out on Switch. Or it might be out like this week, one of those two. Hammerwatch is a game I put like 2 years ago on Steam, which was like this really retro top-down hack and slash RPG with like gauntlet elements to it. That I really liked, and that's coming out on Switch. There's like a cool stealth game that's coming out this week. Enter the Gungeon is coming out.
Holy shit. Just,
yeah, that's it's dope. Fucking crazy. I can't put it down. Like my Switch routinely runs out of batteries when I'm on the couch, just because I can't. It's like the only thing that I'm playing games on when I have free time, and it just is so lovely to see it, like everything that I loved about the Vita, but now all these games run great.
Well,
and you have this nice big screen.
See,
and
I don't know.
What?
On that note, I picked up the Sexy Brutale to play on the plane because we went to Seattle last weekend for a convention. And it has some pretty bad performance issues that are
really
a huge drag. Like, I kind of stopped playing it and started playing something else on the plane because, like sometimes you just like walk into a room and the game would just freeze up for a couple seconds while it figured out what to do. And then if you walked into a room where there was another person in it, which in Sexy Brutale you're not supposed to do, it is sort of this stealth kind of Groundhog Day-esque game where you're trying to affect events.
We've talked about on the show, actually.
Yeah, it like the frame rate kind of goes to shit, which is disappointing.
Yeah, I guess there are examples, now that I think about it, of certainly through the year we've seen, especially like 3D ports of indie games struggle in some situations, and that's a bummer.
I stopped playing, and I don't know if they fixed this, but I stopped playing Overcooked for kind of the same reason, in that like
it has gotten better.
Okay, that's what I have heard. I have not returned to it since then.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was a little bit disappointed in that. But yes, for the most part, it's just fucking great. I looked at my library on Switch while I was trying to find something else to play while I was on the plane. There's like fucking 30 games in there, which is a lot. Like
for a launch year, it's crazy. Yeah. It's, especially it's, for a Nintendo launch
it's
year.
Buck like, wild. It's wild. Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy and awesome.
Any, I mean, I mentioned Solitarica earlier, and that's an older game, but Justin, thank you for that recommendation. That's a good one.
I started playing it again, and I sunk dozens upon dozens of hours.
I think it
into
came out
launch.
I think it came out last year on PC. I don't know when it made its mobile release, and I know that they also added the new decks to the game. Do you want to do you want to talk about it?
Did
reminds
we ever
me
talk
of
about Solitarica?
I don't think so.
Okay, so it's a solitaire based mechanic, which I think is like delicious, no matter how you slice it. Flip Flop Solitaire by Zach Gage this year was another excellent
pocket card jockey. It's a good one.
All good. Solitarica, you have an enemy in front of you that has a deck of cards laid out. Like their pile is already laid out. You see, you know, it's like six or five or six or however many columns of cards that you start with. And you have one card in front of you that you can play on their deck to remove one of their cards. And it's solitaire rules, so it has to be one above or one below to play on it and remove the card, and then that becomes your card, obviously, in sequence of solitaire. But the interesting thing about Solitarica is when you clear an enemy card, it has an energy tied to it, either, I think, wisdom, strength, agility, or...
Defense,
yeah. And you collect that energy when you get rid of an enemy card, and then you use that energy to cast spells. And
kind of Puzzle Quest style, where you're storing up energy by collecting the gems that you use to cast spells.
Right. So there are also gold coins that are instead of energy on some cards, and you use those in between matches to buy new spells and buy new items. But that is the basic thing. It's a dungeon crawler, sort of more boss battles, I guess, because it's like just you against the opponent. But every enemy has like wildly different skill sets and wildly different ways of varying their cards. So there's like maybe they can turn cards into metal so that it takes two plays to get rid of them. Or some of them have really annoying like consolidation spells. So they'll, instead of having five rows of cards that are, or five columns of cards that are much easier to play on, they'll consolidate it down to four columns, so you have fewer options for removing them. Or they'll some are like sticky, so they'll it takes more. It'll lock one of your skills until you remove that card, or you know, all manner of things. And then you have different decks that focus more on different energies. So there's a paladin that I think is like strength and defense, maybe. And, you know, all your spells are sort of centered on those skills. So you have to really rethink your strategy with every new deck. And once you make it to the end of it's like an 18 battle thing, and then you take on the final boss. And when you make it to that, you unlock a lot of these stones. And you actually get the stones after they're called wild stones, I think. You get them after every...
I have
every...
no idea what's going on, Justin. I got to be honest.
Wild stones are like you...
The whole thing. I've lost the thread.
It's solitaire, and then you have skills to help you when you don't have moves to make.
It's just hard to grok when you're just listening to the description.
Sure.
I'm sure it's a lot easier to follow.
Imagine playing solitaire, but when you get a spade, instead of getting nothing, you get magic that lets you cast spells. Okay.
Poker. What was that game called? The poker RPG that came out like 10 years ago on iPhone.
Dang.
Sword
I don't
and poker.
Remember.
Yeah. You ever play Sword and Poker?
Yeah,
oh,
maybe similar to that. But then, Wild Stones are just because it's a, you know, it's the you die and that's the end of your run kind of thing. These are stones that you can use to upgrade your deck. So, like, you get a special bonus whenever you draw an ace or a king or something like that. And you can.
How long does it take start to finish? Like, if you're playing,
it's hard to
like
say
because nice
you could have a really good run and finish it in, you know, 40 minutes or so, but you probably won't.
30-40 minutes usually to get to the end. I think each sort of like battle is usually around 2 minutes. So, and it, you know, which is perfect length for mobile. It feels really good. They have new decks that are even harder to beat it with because they're focused on single energy abilities. But every one feels like really different and fun to play with. And it's a fantastic, fantastic mobile game.
Yeah.
Battle Chef Brigade.
Yeah. I I enjoy Battleship Brigade, but I have stopped playing it. It is another sort of puzzle fusion genre where it is a puzzle game mixed with this sort of 2D combo based action game where you go out into these different environments and collect ingredients either through like harvesting a plant that you find out there or killing an enemy. And then you take it back into the kitchen and then the ingredient that you have is transformed into a set of different colored stones that you then have to match, sort of match three style in a grid that is represented by your cooking instrument. So a big pot or something like that. And it's not a match three in that you like swap the places of gems to form rows or whatever. It is a sort of weird new type of match three where you rotate a square of gems.
I feel like I've played a match three that also did that, but
maybe.
Yeah, it's a little weird.
And you do that, and there's sort of an Iron Chef style modifier on each match where the judges want certain types of ingredients. That is the first thing that you have to put in the dish and sort of base the dish around. And they want certain colors of energy to be like the main focus of the dish. And then you receive points based on how well you adhere to those different rules. And I think it's a really clever game, and there's some good writing and good character stuff going on in the game. If I'm being just honest, I don't love the square rotation match three. Like it sounds like such a simple complaint, but it is like, you know, the main way that you interact with the cooking part of the game. It just never connected with me. The rotating a square of gems to make you know, sets of three just doesn't feel like it's, I can look at a board of Bejeweled, right? Or a dungeon, what's the card dungeon, there's a bunch of these different like puzzle yeah. dungeon type games where you know draw lines like a puzzle
dungeon raid
right, where you're like drawing lines through sets of energy to make big combos. I can see like that type of puzzle game and understand how to make a move while setting myself up for the next move, and I just can't do, like, I don't know the language of this enough for that to ever have really clicked for me. And so I kind of fell off.
Yeah, I didn't play it very much at all, but it didn't really click for me. I think the art style kind of put me off it for whatever reason. I'm sure some people really love it, but for me, I didn't like.
Oh, see, I like it a lot.
Maybe it was because like the minimalist animations were like, there's just like the running animation is like very simplistic. I don't know what it is. And the combat, I'm not really into these sorts of like combo heavy combat games. And then the puzzle stuff didn't really work for me either. I know a lot of people have loved this game.
It really, yeah, this seems like a very much a, you're based on your preference. You may get really into this game. Cause I think it's a really well-made game. It's just, I don't know. There's just some decisions that were made that I don't know. I just really don't. It just didn't click with me for whatever reason. Sometimes that just happens. I also played Pokemon Ultra Sun some this month, and I don't really have much to say except that like I didn't play very much of it because they, holy shit, did not change very much at all from Pokemon Sun. From what I understand, like a lot of the big changes come very late in the game, and I just do not have it in me to play another 30 hours of the same Pokemon game that I already played to get to the new stuff. And it seems, I don't know, this idea of the expansion of a Pokemon generation is, you know, it happens every single time. Pokemon Yellow, Pokemon Crystal, Emerald, all those games, Platinum. But it's just, this one seems like they have reached new depths of not changing a lot of stuff.
It happened just a year after, and
which is not not an uncommon schedule for Pokemon. It's just like I expected a little bit more of a reason to stick with it. They've streamlined the beginning of the game, which in regular old Sun and Moon was like painfully slow. They've sped it up a bit, which is nice, but it's still, I just couldn't shake the feeling that I was just playing the same game that I played last year that I just didn't really feel like it was time to get back into it again.
Yeah. Should we pick a game? I think we could pick a game of the month. Maybe.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else.
Since this is our last episode before the GOTY, does anybody have like any games this year that we did not talk about that maybe you're super late on it and it came out in like April or whatever, yeah. But now is sort of our last time to get into those conversations, I feel like.
Have we talked about Nier Automata at all?
I've heard that one.
I think we should probably dig into that one. So it's made by Yokotaro. It's a Japanese video game, a role-playing action.
I just played Endless Space 2, which I am not like 4X guy at all, but it's a really good strategy game. It's all about like expanding your space empire by collecting these different resources and sending settlers to new planets and then specializing those planets to generate the resources that you need to go for one of the like six specific victory conditions. And I've never been into those games, but what Endless Space 2 does is it has a ongoing sort of narrative quest in each game that's all about how your empire is developing, and so it changes based on that. So you're playing as the United Empire, which is like the human civilization that's all about rapid expansion and all about engineering marvels and stuff like that. But the whole time there's like palace intrigue going on of insurrectionists showing up or strange technology appearing on one of your worlds, and then you have to make decisions with about what to do with those things when they happen, and then it sort of changes the rest of the quest line. And there's also like constant, like as you're exploring the galaxy, there are these constant events that keep popping up that have a lot of like dope flavor, like, oh, you've found a herd of new animals on this planet. Do you want to use them as mounts for your new colonists on this planet, or do you want to eat them? I enjoyed it a lot.
I have one thing that I guess is for this month. I honestly thought it wasn't coming out till next year, but I played it for IGF. Did anybody play Shadowhand?
Oh.
No.
Wait, oh my. Did I?
Maybe. You might have played it for IGF. It's...
That wasn't that weird student game, was it?
No, it's a card game. And it's like Solitaire meets Magic the Gathering.
But okay,
like...
now hold on. How many Solitaire-based card RPGs are we going to be talking about?
I know. Solitaire meets Magic the Gathering-based.
I know. And it has like more RPG elements. I know. This sounds like very, very familiar. It's also really, really, really well made. It has this great, like, swashbuckling art style that is so charming. It like feels like finding a adventure classic book, like when you're at your like student library back when you were a kid, and you'd be like, oh, Treasure Island, and it has all that kind of art inside that is egging you, an elementary school student, along through the book. I don't know. It kind of has that look. And it is super fun. I don't want to go deep into it because, yeah, we've obviously talked about very similar things. But I think
what platform is it on?
It is on PC.
Cool. Anything else? When does that new FTL game come out, Russ, that you did a video on?
That's next year. It's called Into the Breach. It's fantastic.
It looks fucking great.
But it is a next year game.
Okay.
Yeah, it's so effing good.
Then we've done it. We've talked about every video game of 2017.
Congratulations.
Wow. Yeah, we've really done it. I guess we can do Getting Over It for our game this month.
That would
right?
be my vote. I think Getting Over It is excellent.
Yeah.
Is it out on iPhone yet or no?
It is. It's out on iOS right now.
Okay, and PC, obviously.
So that's it, right? The polls are closed, and now we next episode are gonna talk about a bunch of bullshit before we decide that Breath of the Wild is the best game of the year. So that'll be a really fun episode to listen to.
We're gonna compare totally disparate games from one another and determine which is the better disparate game.
How do we have the brackets set up? How are we?
No, I haven't. I'll draw up the brackets, but essentially, I'll try to make it fair where we have an interesting final four, and it's not just Zelda stomping on everything.
Yeah, sure. Cool. Well,
but it has been, even though this last month was kind of toast, it has been an insanely good year for video games. Just there's been a lot of really, really good shit this year. And looking over the Polygon top 10 list was just like a reminder of how many good ass games there were, let alone the top more than that 50. How many?
I think Allegra wrote an article about how there hasn't been a year this good since 2007, which is actually like a theory that I've been thinking about for a while. And that 2007 was a dope year, right? It had BioShock and Orange Box and I think Left 4 Dead, maybe. There were like a ton of great games that year. Yeah. And then there hadn't been a year that good for video games since 1997. So it's just years that end in seven. Whoa. Are just good ass video game years. I'm really looking forward to 2027 and seeing what sort of new surprises Nintendo 2 has for us next time.
Check this out. 1987, Double Dragon, Punch-Out, Contra, Maniac Mansion, Zelda 2, Final Fantasy.
Well, Zelda 2.
R-Type, Wizards and Warriors. Castlevania 2.
1997.
Shadowgate, Afterburner.
97 had GoldenEye, Final Fantasy 7, Symphony of the Night.
Wow.
Yeah, like, it's these 7 years, y'all.
Crazy, weird.
All right, let's wrap it up, Juice.
All right, thank you, everyone, for listening to the Besties. Congratulations to getting over it. Next year, or next time, I guess, it'll probably be next year.
Yeah, we're going to, we're like recording this, like, next, like, in an hour, right? The wrap-up episode, I don't know, it'll be soon.
It'll be soon. All right, so thank you for listening, and be sure to join us again next time for the Besties. Because shouldn't the world's best friends pick the world's best games?
Besties!